Welcome to The Right Kind of Book Talk. I'm your hostess with the mostest, Stacey Wright. Now, you would think I would have got a lot done having 2 weeks off, but with 4 kids under 10 and 2 with high special needs, it wasn't as productive as I would have hoped, but I did get some of the things I planned off my list, and we enjoyed the snow. Yep, that happened. It snowed. We literally went tobogganing yesterday, and we had a lot of fun. I hope you guys have had a nice couple of weeks too. So this is episode 19, Women Writers Who've Paved the Way for Women in Literature, and it's part one. Now, this was a really exciting episode for me to write. I fell down the rabbit hole after I came across a poem called From the Hymn to Inanna, and it was written by priestess Enheduanna, and she lived around 4,500 years ago. Now, that's crazy, right? So this is an excerpt from her translated poem, and it's not the whole thing, it's just part of it. Lady of all powers, in whom light appears, radiant one, beloved of heaven and earth, tiara crowned, priestess of the highest god, my lady, you are the guardian of all greatness. Your hands hold the 7 powers, you lift the powers of being, you have hung them over your finger, you have gathered the many powers, you have clasped them now like necklaces onto your breast. Like a dragon, you poisoned the land. That's gripping. When you roared at this earth in your thunder, nothing green could live. I love it. So poetic. A flood fell from the mountain. You, in honor, foremost in heaven and earth. Lady, riding a beast, you rained fire on the heads of man, taking your power from the highest, following the commands of the highest, lady of all the great rites. Who can understand all this is yours? Chilling, right? But it just shows you that women have flexed their writing skills for millennia. But they've only really just started in the last century to really be given the kudos that they deserve. But before we get into the meat and potatoes of today's episode, it's time to find out what you can get at the bookstore today. Yep, it's publication day. I know you probably miss all the publication day wrecks from the last 2 weeks, and I'm really sorry for that. But I'm going to make up for it today. So first of all, we have A Dagger of Lightning by Meredith R. Lyons, and that's a romantasy. A Duke Never Tells by Suzanne Enoch, and it's a historical romance. Any Trope But You by Victoria Levine, and that's a rom-com. Crash Landing by Emily McQuaid, and it's a women's fiction romance. Direct Descendant by Tanya Huff, and it's a fantasy book. Game of Thorns by Nancy Warren, and that one is a paranormal mystery. I See You Called in Dead by John Kennedy, and that one is a dark comedy book. Say You'll Remember Me by Abby Jimenez. That's a romance. The Gatsby Gambit by Claire Anderson Wheeler. And that one is a mystery. That one has a really cool cover, and I would buy it just for the cover alone. The idea of women who are an inspiration to writers and readers is a really very personal question. I asked it anyway. But I spent the week learning about the authors I found, and I actually have been writing posts about them. It's become like a running series for me on my Instagrams. You can find them at Booklorian Designs and at The Right Kind of Book Talk. And I also did some on my Facebook accounts too, if you're interested in following along the Booklorian Designs or Right Kind Book Talk on Facebook. But getting back to the topic. Now, some scholars believe that the priestess was also the world's first recorded author. In Sumer, the ancient civilization of southern Mesopotamia, where writing originated, all texts were anonymous. If she wrote those words, then she marks the beginning of authorship, the beginning of rhetoric, even the beginning of autobiography. Now, this blows my mind. I've never heard of her. So I guess I'm really not that much of a feminist, hey? I am. She is literally the first notable writer. the very first recorded author. So why the heck are they not teaching this in schools? Now, there's not a lot about her online, but here's what I did find out about her. So she was a Mesopotamian poet, obviously. She had a poem right there. She was also a princess. She was also a priestess of Inanna. That's the goddess. And she was a politician. She was a busy, busy woman, okay? And when her writings were uncovered, scholars didn't take it seriously because, well, she was a woman, so she was dismissed. Her role and her impact were also dismissed in our history, which is a goddamn travesty. As a mother of four daughters, I want to boot F the patriarchy right in its face. Women have had a much larger impact in literature than is widely known. Now, I actually wonder how many women over the years have been minimized by the patriarchy and maybe even had their work stolen. Like, it's not like they would have had any recourse either. Like, how do you go up against that? And that's just, I don't know, it makes my blood boil. But this is a tale as old as time. And rather than getting mad, these authors got even and wrote some of the most amazing books to ever be published. So today we're going to talk about some of the women authors who helped pave the way for women authors to come out from the shadows and take their rightful place in literature. So, like I said, I went to Facebook to see who the usual suspects were for my book people and the kinds of books these amazing women wrote. So let's dive in. Let's start with an author that everybody has heard of. Jane Austen. Now, we've all been exposed to Jane Austen at some point in our lives. Mr. Darcy, anyone? Woo! Now, whether you have read any of the books or even seen one of the movies from the books or heard someone gush about their love of her work, she has been a massive influence on the book world. Did you know Jane Austen published anonymously during her lifetime, with Sense and Sensibility being her very first published work? Did you know that while her novels were considered fashionable, they didn't bring her much personal fame during her lifetime? Did you also know that Jane Austen sold the copyright to Pride and Prejudice for a fixed sum, meaning that she forfeited any future royalties to that book? Really, that was a bad gamble on her part because the book went on to become a bestseller. And did you know that Jane Austen died before finishing her seventh novel and it was called Sandition? I actually did know that, which I was surprised. I actually knew something today. Honestly, I did find it sad that she didn't get the accolades that she deserved while she lived. Jane first started writing at the age of 11, and that's really incredible to me. Like, I don't even know what I was accomplishing at that age, but it certainly wasn't award-winning writing. Also, Charlotte Bronte was really not a fan of Jane's, and that's pretty horrible considering they both had an uphill battle in the writing world, which was very heavily male-dominated. Jane's notable works consist of Emma, Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Mansfield Park, Northanger Abbey, and Persuasion. She was also a feminist. Austen believed that a woman should not get married if she wasn't in love, and for that time, that was a really outlandish thing to believe. And the more I learned about her, the more I love her. Now, which one of her books was your favorite? Now, if I was to start a Jane Austen book club, would you join me? Shoot me a message if you would. Now, I'm a massive fan of Emma. It was a book I read a ton as a teenager, and my battered copy literally had no cover on it. I actually don't own a readable copy of Emma, or actually any of the Austen books, because I bought them all in leatherbound, and nobody is allowed to touch them, okay? You're not allowed to read them, you're not allowed to touch them. They're just pretty up on the shelf. But I really feel the time is right for all six books to get a reread. So I'm probably going to have to go thrifting and look for some copies. If you have never read Jane Austen, let's just talk real quick about her books. Now, Emma, the book is set in Highbury, England, in the early 19th century. And the novel centers on Emma Woodhouse. And she was a precocious young woman whose misplaced confidence in her matchmaking abilities caused several romantic misadventures. Like, it's really quite a quirky book. Pride and Prejudice. Now, this one centers on the burgeoning relationship between Elizabeth Bennet, the daughter of a country gentleman, and Fitzwilliam Darcy. And he was a rich aristocratic landowner. And for me, this book was like the first grumpy sunshine trope like that I ever enjoyed. Persuasion. Now, this one tells the story of a second chance, the reawakening of love between Anne Elliot and Captain Frederick Wentworth, whom 8 years earlier, she had like been persuaded not to marry. It's also one of my favorites. Mansfield Park. Fanny Price is a self-effacing and unregarded cousin cared for by the Bertram family in their country home. His moral strength eventually wins her complete acceptance by the Bertram family and marriage to Edmund Bertram himself. Actually, I've only read this one a few times. It's not one of my favorites, but I'm definitely going to do a reread of it. Northanger Abbey. Catherine Morland, the daughter of a country parson, is the innocent who is abroad who gains worldly wisdom, first in the fashionable society of Bath and then at Northanger Abbey itself, where she learns not to interpret the world through her reading of Gothic thrillers. Now, that book was epic, epic. Sense and Sensibility. Now, this one tells the story of the impoverished Dashwood family, and it basically focuses on the two sisters, Eleanor and Marianne. Personifications of good sense, common sense, and sensibility, emotionality, respectfully. They become destitute upon the death of their father, who ends up leaving their ancestral home of Norland Park to their half-brother, John. Now, I highly recommend giving Austen a go if you haven't read any of her work yet. Like, I know she's a difficult read, especially if you're not used to Old English, but you definitely should give it a try. Okay, so who else came up a lot on Facebook? It was the Bronte sisters. Now, we've already discovered that Charlotte Bronte really wasn't a fan of Jane Austen's, and that was a real shame. I feel like women should have stuck together at that time, even if they didn't agree with the books they were writing. Also, I just found out there were actually 4 Bronte sisters, not just 2, but 4. And the third one also released a couple of books. I've never actually heard of her books before. Her name was Anne Bronte, and she wrote Agnes Grey and The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. I like to think I'm more in touch with my classics than this, and I was actually pretty mortified that I had some kind of like amnesia around this person. So I remedied that by borrowing both of her books from my local library. And honestly, she had more talent than her sisters, in my humble opinion. Now, I've already mentioned her sister, Charlotte. Charlotte wrote the iconic book, Jane Eyre. And that one is one of my most loved classics. So for me to say that Anne was more talented, believe it. And her other sister was Emily, and she wrote the classic Wuthering Heights. Now, I personally prefer Jane Eyre. Now, I did really enjoy Wuthering Heights, but Jane Eyre was just, it was better. It was better written. But did I do a poll? Yeah, I did. And guess what? Out of the 108 people that I polled, 54 people apiece. Yeah. So it was literally a 50-50 split. I laughed so hard when it was over that I fell out of my chair. So I literally can't even answer which book is actually better. Now, Charlotte's first book was rejected from every single publisher, but she did not give up. And I love that. She was told to give up on writing because she was a woman, and that was not a womanly thing to do. And she really hated to clean. And I love that. She didn't care. Charlotte, Emily, and Anne Bronte did not originally publish their works under their own names. Instead, they went by the names Currier, Ellis, and Acton Bell. Like many Victorian women publishing at the time, the sisters chose male pseudonyms. Of the three sisters, Anne Bronte's work are not read nearly as widely, but like I said, they really should be. Anne was one of the most progressive of all the Brontes, and it shows in her writing. Anne's novels openly challenge the concept of a woman's place in traditional Victorian England. Anne Bronte's second and last novel, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, is considered to be one of the first feminist novels in that time. At the time of The Tenant of Wildfell Hall's publication in 1848, the actions of the protagonist, Helen Graham, were absolutely shocking to Victorian readers. A woman leaving an abusive husband to make a life for herself on her own terms? Revolutionary. So let's take a look at each of their top book and what it was about. So Charlotte Bronte, she wrote Jane Eyre, and it's about a 10-year-old orphan who lives with her uncle's family. Her parents had died of typhus. Other than the nursemaid, the family basically ostracizes Jane. She is later sent to the austere Lowood Institute, a charity school, where she and the other girls are literally mistreated. Lowood, as the name suggests, is the low point in Jane's young life. In the face of such adversity, however, she gathers strength and confidence. So it's a realistic portrayal of the inner life of a woman, noting her struggles with her natural desires and social condition. Loved it. Loved it. Emily Bronte. She wrote Wuthering Heights. The story is that of the fierce, passionate love between the more loving wild girl, Catherine Earnshaw, and the poor, equally wild-spirited boy her father takes in to be raised as her brother. His name is Heathcliff. The main themes of the book are love, passion, and vengeance. It is the love between Heathcliff and Catherine that permeates the novel, though it assumes dangerous proportions as the plot thickens. Catherine basically rejects Heathcliff, choosing instead Eglinton. It's widely considered as a great romance, but I really didn't feel that way about it, to be honest. It was rather toxic and everyone was pretty much a butthole. And lastly, Anne Bronte, and she wrote The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. And this one tells the story of a young wife during the Regency period in England who literally runs away from her drunken, adulterous, verbally abusive husband, an act virtually unheard of at this time in history. Now, I found this book really easy to connect to, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was deep and thought-provoking. Honestly, of all four of these authors so far, they have really earned their place in literary history for me. So who are we going to look at next? Louisa May Alcott. Little Women is a book I hold near and dear to my heart. But did you know that Louisa was one of the earliest suffragettes? In the 1870s, Alcott wrote for a women's rights periodical, and she went door to door in Massachusetts to encourage women to vote. She was an absolute badass. She also used to pretend to be her own servant to trick her fans in hopes they would leave her doorstep, which is hilarious. I guess her face wouldn't have been on the back cover, so how would anyone know that it wasn't her, right? Little Women was heavily based on her own family, which is very cool. Much of Little Women is semi-autobiographical in nature. Alcott used her sister's lives and childhood memories to create much of the story and detail in her novel. She is Jo, the bold girl who is desperate to escape the Victorian entrapments of her sex and who longs to go out and do daring things. She even said that she didn't much like girls other than her sisters. So this really makes a lot of sense. She didn't have any kids of her own, which is kind of sad, but she did take care of her niece. Now, it's funny because she was approached to write a book for girls and she really didn't want to. She obviously did because, hello, we have Little Women. But it's funny that her most well-known and treasured book is a book she was really resistant to write. Now, she actually wrote a lot of pulp fiction. In case you don't know what pulp fiction is, I'm just going to give you a quick overview. It was literally a genre of cheap, sensational, and often action-packed stories, categorized by its publication in low-cost magazines and novels printed on pulp paper. So Tarantino did not coin the phrase. It's been around for a heck of a long time. And the genre's name comes from the cheap wood pulp paper used for printing the magazines and novels. So Pulp Fiction featured a wide range of genres, including crime, science fiction, war, westerns, horror, and romance, often with sensational and action-orientated storylines. How cool is this? Now, Pulp Fiction was initially marketed to adult audiences with a combination of eye-catching covers, low prices, and crazy storylines. I was literally struck speechless when I uncovered this. I had no idea that my sweet Louisa, who gave me Joe March, was secretly writing and publishing Pulp Fiction anonymously or sometimes under a pseudonym, exploring themes like murder and treachery and so much more before her children's literature fame. I literally stopped scrolling, just kind of sat there stunned for a while. I was like, ah! I really underestimated who she was as a person, as an author, and I'm so glad I did a deep dive on her. She is an even bigger inspiration to me now. Did you know any of this stuff about her? Like, she's written a ton of books, but I couldn't find any of her Pulp Fiction stuff to read. Boo to that. I really hoped that my research into Mary Shelley isn't as eye-opening. It is. As we all know, she wrote Frankenstein, and it's widely considered the start of the sci-fi genre. It's such an iconic book, as it was exploring themes of things like creation, responsibility, and the dangers of unchecked ambition. Here are some of the things you may not have known. She literally published this book twice. The first was the 1818 version. She published it anonymously in three volumes. This is considered to be the first edition and closer to Shelley's original vision, according to some scholars. Now, some scholars argue this version has deeper thematic development within a shorter number of pages. Now, it was republished again in 1831 and published under Mary Shelley's name and included as a single volume. Now, this one includes revisions and edits. Some were actually prompted by public criticism of the novel, saying it was too radical. Now, some scholars argue that the 1831 version has more traditional literary appeal. I can't answer that. The 1831 edition is considered the authoritative edition because Mary Shelley's made such significant revisions in that version. The 1831 edition relegates human action to fate and undercuts the aggregation family unit. I didn't know there were two versions, not one single bloody clue, and I feel like a noob. There was like over 60 theatrical makings of Frankenstein, and that number also astounded me. And the last movie that was made was in 2021. But here are some things you may not have known about Mary Shelley. Now, she was a runaway teen bride. Mary Shelley, whose maiden name was Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, that was a mouthful, eloped with Percy Shelley when she was just 16 years old, and they later had a difficult time financially, which makes sense. Her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, was a prominent feminist writer and philosopher known for her work, A Vindication of the Rights of Women. The story of Frankenstein is said to have been inspired by a nightmare that Mary Shelley had during a period of bad weather in 1816, known as the Year Without Summer. While staying with Percy Shelley in Switzerland, she had a lot of tragedy in motherhood. Mary Shelley's own experiences with motherhood were marked by tragedy as she suffered a lot of miscarriages and the deaths of children in infancy, which may have influenced the themes of loss and grief in her writing, because her writing is really tragic. Mary Shelley learned to write her name by tracing the letters of her mother's headstone. And Mary Shelley, by her own admission, was a bisexual. I'm going to admit that there was a lot to not know about someone who is a massive icon in women's literature. Like, did you know any of these things about her? I really don't think my nerves can handle much more. Like, I really don't. Oh, okay. You want me to go on? Okay. You talked me into it. Let's move on to Agatha Christie. You've all heard of her. She is literally the only crime writer to have created two equally famous and much loved characters, Poirot and Miss Marple. Now, I'm a huge fan of both. But did you also know she was a huge dog lover? I had no idea. I'm a huge dog lover too. Did you also know that she published 6 of her books under a pseudonym? When she wasn't writing some of the most classic crime thrillers of all time, Agatha Christie was actually writing under the alias Mary Westmacott. The 6 Westmacott novels were bittersweet explorations of love and life, and much of Christie's joy were rather successful. The name Mary Westmacott comes from Christie's second name, Mary, and the Westmacott were some distant relatives of hers. She was successfully kept that identity secret for over 20 years. Now, her first novel was written as a dare. Though Agatha Christie grew up as an avid reader, she did not pen her first novel until her sister Madge dared her to do so. And the dare produced Christie's first thriller, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, about the poisoning of a one Mrs. Inglethorpe, and was introduced. This was the introduction of the Belgium detective Poirot. It was rejected by 6 publishers before it was finally printed in 1920. Agatha Christie's childhood was really unconventional for many reasons, one of which was that she was homeschooled. And her mother was insistent that she not learn to read until she was at the age of 8. Now, fortunately, the bright young Agatha was able to teach herself, and she fell madly in love with English poetry. She received no formal education until she was sent to a finishing school in Paris at the age of 15. Now, this fact is actually one of my favorites. Poirot received a New York Times obituary. Poirot was one of the only fictional characters in history to receive an obituary from the New York Times. When he perished in the 1975 novel, Curtain Reaction, fans went nuts. The New York Times printed a front page obituary from the character on August 6th, detailing his fictional life achievements. But seeing as though Poirot's debut was also that of Christie's, it is really poetic that the following year, Christie herself also passed away. Have you ever noticed that although most of Christie's novels involve murder, she was not big on gruesome violence? Many of her slain characters were actually poisoned. And this is likely due to the fact that Christie's past working in a dispensary during wartime. It kind of equipped her with the working knowledge of pharmaceuticals. In fact, her knowledge of poisons was such that her debut novel, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, received a glowing write-up from a pharmaceutical magazine. How cool was that? She once disappeared for 11 days. In a plot worthy of one of her own novels, Agatha Christie disappeared from her London home in 1926 without a trace for 11 days. 1926 was a turbulent year for the writer. Her mother had just passed away, and her husband, Archie, had recently revealed he was having an affair and had asked her for a divorce. Archie then left her home, her car was found abandoned, and the police feared the worst. They even went as far as dredging local lakes and even tapping Archie's phone. And then 11 days later, she turned up at the Old Swan Hotel, checked in under her husband's mistress's name. It's hilarious. To this day, no one seems to know exactly what happened, but it seemed likely she simply just wanted to get away from her tumultuous life. And the piece de resistance on Agatha Christie was she was a surfer. How cool is that? She had a heck of a career, even when her life was rather unconventional. Props! So who's going to top Agatha? Let's see if Shirley Jackson can. Now, she wrote The Haunting of Hill House, and honestly, it secured her crown as the Queen of Horror. But did you know she had a huge library of witchcraft books? Jackson became interested in witchcraft during her early years in college and continued to study it for the rest of her life. Many of her books, including Life Among the Savages, contain references to historical witchcraft chronicles or manuals, also known as grimoires. She is already a very interesting person. But what else did I find out about her? She may have liked the occult, but she actually did not believe in ghosts. She said she had never had a supernatural experience, so she couldn't believe in something she hadn't experienced. Now, she based The Haunting of Hill House, her famous ghost story, on historical accounts of haunted houses and pictures she had collected of spooky estates. That's insane, man. Insane. But did you know she also dropped out of college? And she struggled with her mental health and she had agoraphobia. Now, I wonder if all the occult books had scared the bejesus out of her. You never know, right? But did you know that her agent shielded her from rejection? Jackson struggled to get published in the early years of her career. For each successful submission, she also suffered many rejections. Like the New Yorker published four of her stories in 1943, four again in 1944, and then nothing until they published The Lottery in 1948. But she was in really good company here because the magazine also rejected all of J.D. Salinger's early submissions. But because she tended to get despondent whenever she received a rejection letter, she asked her agent to tell her only of her acceptances. If it was unavoidable, he sometimes broke the news to her himself. I feel this with my whole soul. The idea of rejection is abhorrent, and I couldn't have handled that either, so I probably would have done the same thing. Now, it's funny because The Haunting of Hill House is one of the most terrifying books I have ever read. And I just recently did a reread of it with the audio book. This was probably a few months ago, and it has really stood up to the test of time, in my opinion. It was really atmospheric and chilling to the point that I actually felt a little unsettled walking around my own home. And I love horror. Now, this episode, it kind of ended up being a lot longer than I anticipated. So I'm going to split it into being a two-parter. So I'm going to wrap this episode up with the iconic Harper Lee and Sylvia Plath. So Harper Lee wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. It's one of my most beloved books from my teen years. Yeah, I know I have a lot of them. Sue me. One of the things that shook me about her is that she had a really close friendship with Truman Capote. Now, I had no idea they even knew each other, so that was a little jarring for me. And Dill, in the book, was based on Capote. And that's even more shocking. But it's funny, now that I know that, I can totally see it. Lee even assisted Capote with research for his novel, In Cold Blood, accompanying him to Kansas several times to help his investigative work surrounding the Clutter family, the murders that happened. In 1960, Lee wrote her own account of the crime, which formed the centerpiece of Capote's book, and also profiled the investigator of the case for Grapevine, though without a byline to avoid detracting from her friend's work. Their relationship soured after Capote didn't credit Lee to her liking. Yikes. Harper Lee was set to become a lawyer, like her father, because he's a lawyer. But 6 months before she was due to graduate, she actually quit to pursue writing. That is ballsy. But her gamble really paid off, as To Kill a Mockingbird is one of the best-selling books of all time. Despite complaints against her novel, she sold over 40 million copies worldwide and received widespread critical acclaim, winning the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1961. Well earned, in my opinion, but she once said of Mockingbird, "I wished I'd never written the damn thing." Harper once expressed her regrets to writer Mills in those words. A few years later, Mills reminded her of the remark and asked if she still felt that way. Harper replied, "Sometimes, but then it passes." Now imagine feeling this way about something you wrote. It's so sad. And she also hated public speaking, and she apparently was really frugal. I love it. So let's close this out with Sylvia Plath. We all know her tragic story, but did you know that she was an artist? Art was actually her first love, and it's what she wanted to do with her life, but she was persuaded to pursue writing instead. And it makes you wonder if this was one of the things that sent her mental health spiraling. Her artwork is actually quite exceptional, and I'm going to show you some pieces on the screen while I'm still talking. She was really talented. She published her first poem at age 8, which is amazing. One of the saddest facts about her is that she committed suicide in the same house that W.B. Yeats had once lived, and her son Nicholas also committed suicide. Now, that is a lot of devastation for one family, but it makes a lot of sense as she really struggled with depression throughout her life. Now, a psychologist did research on her mental health and believes she may have had BPD. Now, whether or not that's true is really irrelevant at this point, because she's not here to know what kind of mental health issues afflicted her, and I'm not here to conjecture on that. Her book, The Bell Jar, addresses the questions of socially acceptable identity. It examines Esther's quest to forge her own identity, to be herself rather than what others expected her to be. Esther is expected to become a housewife and a self-sufficient woman without the options to achieve independence. Now, this book had a profound impact on me as a young adult, but Sylvia's poetry is really where she shone. Rest in peace, Sylvia. So next week, I'll do part two, and I'm going to cover probably Margaret Atwood, Virginia Woolf, Kate Chopin, Charlotte Smith, Ayn Rand, Toni Morrison, Anne Rice, Alice Walker, Edith Wharton, and probably Isabel Allende. Are there any authors, female authors, I may have missed, but you feel need to be mentioned in the episode? Let me know. Now, I really hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you do, please hit the subscribe button on youtube.com/@therightkindofbooktalk. Follow me on TikTok. That's at right.kind.book.talk. I'm also under there on @bookalorian_designs. Instagram is @therightkindofbooktalk. Again, I have an Instagram from my Bookalorian page, Bookalorian Designs. Facebook @rightkindbooktalk. Now, you can always email me at therightkindofbooktalk@gmail.com. Give me some feedback. Give me some topics. I'm still looking for maybe some indie authors to come on and talk about their books. The Right Kind of Book Talk can be found on anywhere where a podcast is being aired, pretty much. So Spotify, Apple Music, RSS, Apple Podcasts, Player FM, Amazon. I also post them on my Facebook pages, which there are three of. So you can always find me. Now, if you send one of your friends to YouTube and they subscribe, you can double chances of winning prizes, okay? I'm trying to get more subscribers, so do it. Have the reading day you deserve, and I will see you next week. This is Stacey Wright signing off from The Right Kind of Book Talk. Take care, readers.